This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Is the Long Island serial killer in custody? That is the question we are asking at this hour, as an arrest has been made over the Gilgo Beach murders on Long Island. The enigma began with a series of baffling disappearances leading to grisly discoveries that shocked the nation. Today in a press conference, we learned the details of the man that they suspect to be the Long Island serial killer, Rex Heroman. Let's go to the press conference that took place just moments ago with the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you all for coming. I'm standing here with my law enforcement partners in the Gilgo Task Force to announce the indictment of defendant Rex Andrew Heroman, 59 years of age. And he's been arrested by the Suffolk County Police Department's homicide detectives, and he's been indicted in a grand jury presentation by the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office for the murders of Melissa Bartholomew, Megan Waterman, and Amber Costello. The investigation of Maureen Brainerd Barnes is ongoing. These young women went missing between July of 2007 and September of 2010. They were found in December of 2010 by the Suffolk County Police Department, and then there was nothing, absolutely nothing. For the next 13 years, their cases went unsolved until today. When I took office in January of 2022, I made Gilgo a priority. I made Gilgo a priority before I took office. I met with the victims' families, some of whom I'm proud to have standing with us today. And I told them that we were going to handle this case differently. We were going to do it differently. And that when I showed up, you weren't going to see me calling the media and being on Gilgo Beach with a giant magnifying lens looking for clues 12 years after the case. What I was going to do was I was going to work with my task force. We were going to form a task force. We were going to work with the Suffolk County Police Department. We were going to work with the Suffolk County Sheriff's Office. We were going to work with the New York State Police. We were going to work with our FBI. And we were going to form this task force, and we were going to work together, and we were going to use the grand jury, the power of the grand jury to reach a determination in this case. Because the grand jury has two things. It has power, it has reach. You could obtain documents, you could interview witnesses. But the other thing that the grand jury has secrecy. No one knows what you do when you operate a grand jury proceeding. And we knew that when we were investigating this case and when we dealt with the media or whatever it was we were doing, we were playing before a party of one, because we knew the person responsible for these murders would be looking at us. So we were very careful how we handled the investigation. We maintained the integrity of the investigation. Most importantly of all, we maintained the secrecy of that investigation, and I think that's paid dividends as we've seen today. Now, I think that when we had the task force, the first thing we did got together with Suffolk County Police Commissioner Rodney Harrison, and we formed the task force. Our first meeting was February 1st of 2022. And what we did, what all of the agencies here, we made the commitment. We were going to take our talented, our most talented investigators. So in the district attorney's office, we took ADAs, myself included. We took analysts. We took detective investigators. And they worked on a daily basis with other talented investigators from all of the agencies here. We started that in February 1st in 2022. 6 weeks later, on March 14th, 2022, the name Rex Heroman was first mentioned as a suspect in the Gilgo case. A New York State investigator was able to identify him in a database. And from that point on, we used the power of the grand jury, over 300 subpoenas and search warrants, looking into this individual's background to bring us to this day. So I'm proud. I know that this case is over, but I'm proud of what we've accomplished up to this point. I know we have more to accomplish, but I'm also thankful for the partnership of the task force, because certainly without the participation of the task force, we wouldn't be standing here. Before I thank some folks and turn it over to our partners, I just want to talk a little bit about the evidence in the case. I know a lot of people know about the case. As I indicated, the victims went missing between July of 2010 and July of 2007 and September of 2010. And in December of 2010, their bodies were recovered. They were buried in a similar fashion, at a similar location, in a similar way. All the women were petite. They all did the same thing for a living. They all advertised the same way, and there were similarities with regard to the crime scenes. All the women were bound at the head, at the midsection, or at the chest, and later at the legs. The other thing I think that's been talked about in the media was they were bound by burlap. That has taken a life of its own in the media, and the burlap has been described or thought to be the burlap that's used at a nursery that's not the burlap that was used in this case. The burlap was camouflage burlap used for duck blinds of hunting. So it was used to purposely hide the bodies. One thing that became immediately apparent was at the time of each of the murders, the murderer, the defendant Heurman, he got a cell phone and a burner phone, which is prepaid and anonymous. And for each of the murders, he got an individual burner phone, and he used that to communicate with the victims. Then shortly after the death of the victims, he then would get rid of the burner phone. And right away in December of 2012, FBI CAST analysts, special agents with the CAST unit of the FBI, they immediately began looking at that cell site data. They compared the victims' phones with the burner phones, and they immediately honed in on some similarities, specifically in the Massapequa Park area. And they looked at an area of a confluence of four cell towers, and they realized that this had significance, because the perpetrator of these crimes was probably located within this area at or around the times of the murderer. And that was mapped out. That was called the box, and it was an area in Massapequa Park. The FBI also managed to do that for an area in Midtown Manhattan. And so that was an investigative lead. The other investigative lead at the time was, even though there was a significant amount of time that elapsed with regard to before the victims were recovered, there was some significant evidence recovered. Specifically, there was a hair recovered from Maureen Brainerd Barnes from a belt buckle that was around her legs. With regard to Megan Waterman, there were three hairs recovered from her. One from around her head area, one from around her leg area in the burlap, and then there was one caught in between the tape. That was recovered. Amber Costello also had a significant hair that was recovered during the time of the recovery. The crime scene, because it was out there for so long, and because it was exposed to the elements, those hairs were degraded, so you couldn't use traditional DNA analysis on it. You would have to wait and use mitochondrial DNA. And back in 2010, the technology wasn't there for mitochondrial DNA. So the investigation proceeded, but also technology proceeded as well. And then in February of 2022, we formed the task force. We began working collectively. And then a mere 6 weeks later, on March 14th, 2022, Rex Heurman was identified for the first time. And the manner in which that was done was the New York State investigator looked at a database. Amber Costello, the day before her disappearance on September 1st, 2010, she met with an individual for the purposes of having him pay her money for her services, but she involved herself in a ruse where once the individual gave her money, and other individuals came into the house, pretended to be significant others, confronted the individual with the purpose of making that individual uncomfortable, having him leave without retrieving his money. And that's exactly what happened. So that individual was identified as a person who was between 6'4 and 6'6, a large man, thickly built, not necessarily overly muscular, but just a naturally big person with glasses, white, and dark hair. Also of significance was that the fact that he was driving a dark-colored, black, first-generation Chevrolet Avalanche with a very unique feature that was between it was a pickup truck, so it was between the cab and the bed, and that was identified. Again, that was back in 2010, but it wasn't until March of 2022. That database was searched by the task force, and this individual was identified. That individual was Rex Heurman, the defendant, and right away there were some commonalities that came right to the fore. Rex Heurman, 6'4", largely a large person, not necessarily muscular, but a very physically large person. He has glasses. He has the dark hair, and also of particular note, he owned at the time that first generation Chevy Avalanche. But there was more. He lived at 105 First Avenue, which was located within that box area that the FBI first discovered in 2012. But there was more. Also, he worked at the time at an architect, he owned his own architectural firm at an address at 19 West 36th Street in Midtown Manhattan. And that was also the area of interest that was identified by the FBI in 2012. Again, that was March 14th, 2022. And from that point on, our partners and my office, we used the grand jury to continue to investigate, and we executed over 300 subpoenas, search warrants pertaining to this individual to find out more information. One of the things that we did is we followed him because we wanted to get an abandonment sample of his DNA, which we were able to do. We also got DNA samples, abandonment samples from his family. And then we went back and we got mitochondrial DNA testing. And with regard to, there's an aspect of New York State law that doesn't allow me to talk about DNA testing, specifically at press conferences. It's so I can't do that. However, at the arraignment, and also when we filed our bail letter, we talked about the significance of that evidence. So, if anyone needs to see that, but suffice to say, that evidence was significant, especially with regard to the other evidence that we had developed. But it was another interesting aspect. We looked at the Heurman family travel records, and we learned that during the murders of the last three women, Barthelemy, Waterman, and Costello, that during the commission of those murders, the defendant's wife and children were out of New York State, and he was alone in the tri-state area. We also went back and looked at his cell site records, and we compared his personal cell site records with that of the four target phones, and we saw that there was areas of commonality. In other words, that whenever the target phones would bounce off a cell tower, if the Yerman personal phone bounced off a tower, it was always consistent and in close proximity with the target phones. And at no time was there ever an instant where those target phones were, for instance, in New Jersey while the defendant was on Long Island. So that was completely consistent. The other thing that we looked at was we looked at his use of burner phones, and we followed, using the grand jury, using the great investigative help from our partners, we followed his use of burner phones. We were able to identify seven separate burner phones that he used. We were able to use fictitious or fraudulent email addresses and get Google warrants, and from there we got his searches, and we learned what the defendant was searching. In a 14-month period, he had over 200 searches pertaining to the Gilgo investigation. Not only was he looking at investigative insight, he was looking, trying to figure out how is the task force using cell phones to try to figure out what's happening. What are the developments with regard to the task force? And this really supported our decision to keep our investigative focus secret, because we knew that one person would be watching, and we didn't want to give him any insight into what we were doing, and we also didn't want him to know just how close we were getting. So we maintained the grand jury secrecy, and we maintained the integrity of our investigation. In addition to those Gilgo searches, he was compulsively searching pictures of the victims, but not only pictures of the victims, pictures of their relatives, their sisters, their children, and he was trying to locate those individuals. In addition to that, there was a lot of torture, porn, and what you would consider, depictions of women being abused, being raped, and being killed. In addition to all of that, we continued to look, and we were able to determine that Chevy Avalanche that was used during the commission of the Amber Costello crime, that Chevy Avalanche was in South Carolina. And again, with the help of our partners, we were able to seize that Chevy Avalanche pursuant to a search warrant, and we're certainly going to analyze that. In addition to that, pursuant to the arrest of the defendant last night by the Suffolk County Police Department, we obtained one of his burner phones, his last burner phones. This case is not over, it's only beginning. We're continuing to execute search warrants, and we anticipate getting more evidence. Before I turn it over to my partners, I want to thank a lot of people in the room. First and foremost, I want to thank the victims in this case. You know, it's always inspiring as a prosecutor when you get to meet the victims. And while sometimes our defendants could embody the very worst of humanity, it seems that invariably our victims embody the very best of what it means to be human. And in this case, it was no different. I've gotten to know the families, and I'm inspired by them, and I'm impressed by their patience and by their dogged persistence in not only supporting their lost sisters or mother or daughter, but also really, you know, really standing for victims everywhere. So I want to thank them all so much. And I want to let them know that we're going to continue to work this case. The next thing I want to do, I want to thank our partners. I want to thank Suffolk County Police Commissioner Rodney Harrison. You know, we said it was a change. And when we talked about, you know, not going before the media, if you see, you know, Rodney did go before the media. But it was always in a very controlled manner, and it was always with a controlled purpose. Again, we did that because we knew we were playing before an audience of one person. And so I want to thank Rodney for his partnership. Most importantly, I want to thank Rodney for his integrity. I think in the past, what the reason why these various investigations fell short was because there was a lot of outside influence, a lot of people who had nothing to do with the investigation, nothing to do with the investigation or any of the agencies that were actually handling the investigation. They still asserted pressure on those investigations. That did not happen with our task force. Our task force was run by our members, and we did what we thought was in the best investigative steps and what was in the best interest of the investigation. So I want to thank Rodney for that, and his whole team. I know that we have Suffolk County Homicide here, Kevin Beyer, we've got Inspector Rowan, and I know that they've been around, and I know that they're here, and I know that they stand in the shoes of their past investigators, and I want to congratulate them, and I want to thank them for their partnership. I also want to thank Sheriff Errol Toulon. Everything I said about Rodney, I could say about Errol. Errol is an unbelievable partner. He was an unbelievable partner in this case. During the pendency of this case, and one of the reasons why we had to take this case down was we learned that the defendant was using these alternate identities and these alternate instruments to continue to patronize sex workers, which of course made us very nervous. But with the help of the sheriff and his database and his analysts, we were able to continually stay one step ahead of the defendant. So thank you, Sheriff Toulon. I want to thank the FBI. I know Assistant Director in Charge Michael Brodak is here. I want to thank his entire team. You know, when you have the FBI, not only do you have tremendous resources and insight, whether it's the Behavioral Sciences Unit, whether it's CAST, whether it's CART, which is their computer unit, but you also have the ability to seize a car in South Carolina. I can't seize a car in South Carolina without the FBI. So thank you for that, and thank you for your partnership, and thank you for your willingness to work with us. I want to thank the New York State Troopers. I know Major Udice is here and his team. You know, this case is emblematic of great cooperation, but we always get that same level of cooperation from the state police, no matter what case we're working. So I want to thank them. Their investigators did great work on this job and in this case, and we couldn't have done it without them. Lastly, I want to thank Nassau County Police Commissioner Pat Ryder. I don't know if he's here. Did he make it? You know, this case, as I said, spans, you know, 13 years. And during that time, you know, Pat Ryder has been our neighbor to the west. When it started, I think he was a sergeant, detective sergeant, maybe uniform sergeant. But whatever, whenever we needed something to be done or whenever the task force needed something to be done, Pat Ryder would do it, and he would do it quietly without much fanfare. And we know he would keep the confidentiality of our grand jury and our investigation. So I want to thank him for that. And with that, I will turn it over to Commissioner Rodney Harrison.
Good afternoon. today is a good day. And before I acknowledge the individuals that had a role in getting to this place, I would first and foremost like to offer my deepest condolences to the family members. To the family members of Amber Costello, Melissa Bartholomew, Megan Waterman. I can only imagine what you had to endure over the last decade regarding knowing that your killer was still loose. God bless you. So I've had the privilege of being the police commissioner nearly about 2 years now, and I have had that investigative experience in the NYPD as a detective, as the chief of detectives. And when I was going through the process of being the police commissioner, my engagement with the county executive was I was very familiar with this unfortunate homicides. And I wanted to let it be known that this was going to be our number one priority. But I also want to make this very clear, that this arrest was made by the investigators assigned to the task force. I announced during a press conference 18 months ago about a new team effort that was going to investigate the homicide, and that was going to consist of people from Ray Tierney's office, from Mike Braddock, FBI. Mike, thank you so much. State Police, Steve, appreciate your support. Dr. Earl Talon, Jr., thank you, sir. As well as the investigators from the homicide detectives in Suffolk County. Gentlemen, thank you for all you've done working together with us, making sure we are here today. I also want to thank my partner, Pat Ryder. Pat, good seeing you, man. And former NYPD Police Commissioner, Keyshawn Sewell, for providing resources to assist in the investigation that brought us here today. So, one of my first acts was to survey the scene. When I first got assigned as a police commissioner, me and Kevin Breyer went over to Gilgo Beach. I want to thank Kevin. You know, when I first met Kevin, he broke the whole case down and where we stood. He knew the case like the back of his hand. He worked tirelessly in this case. Kev was in charge of overseeing the task force since its creation, and you did a phenomenal job, Kev. Thank you. So there's something that I learned from a former NYPD police commissioner, James O'Neill, which is in order to fight crime or to solve investigations, you have to make sure you're working with your law enforcement partners. The blueprint in making this arrest was a whole team effort. Everybody left their egos at the door and made sure that they brought the knowledge and the resources to this investigation. Fresh eyes on this case and the resiliency of our investigators allowed us to identify Rex Heuermann. Ladies and gentlemen, Rex Heuermann is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families. If not for the members of this task force, he would still be on the streets today. However, even with this arrest, we're not done. There's more work to do in this investigation regarding the other victims of the Gilgo Beach bodies that were discovered. I'm going to encourage anybody that still has information, call our Crime Stoppers hotline, 1-800-220-TIPS. I want to recognize and thank my chief of detectives, John, Thank you for your great work. Deputy Police Commissioner Anthony Carter, both of you who provided update information regarding the case and let it be known if there was any resources that they needed, that you brought it to my attention. Since the discovery of the first victim, there's been a lot of scrutiny and criticism regarding how this investigation was handled. I will tell you this, the investigators were never discouraged. They continued and uncovered evidence and followed leads. They never stopped working and will continue to work tirelessly until we bring justice to all the families involved. Last but not least, I want to thank my predecessors that came before me, the work that they did. I want to thank them for really laying the foundation that helped us get to here today. Thanks, Ray.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Brodack. I'm the FBI Special Agent in Charge of the New York Office's Criminal Division. The FBI expanded its full set of resources in support of our local and state partners to advance this investigation. The charges show that we can overcome the most difficult challenges when federal, state, and local law enforcement work together under one task force. While nothing can fill the void caused by the loss of a loved one, through today's announcement, we are hopeful that the families of the victims begin to experience a sense of peace, closure, and justice, and that the general public feels safer knowing that an alleged killer is no longer roaming free. The actions taken today should serve as a reminder that the FBI, along with our law enforcement partners, will continue to be resolute in our determination to bring all offenders to justice, no matter how many years has passed. I would like to thank Suffolk County District Attorney Ray Tierney and his prosecution team, Suffolk County Police Commissioner Rodney Harrison and the Suffolk County Police Department, the New York State Police, and the investigators and staff of the FBI New York Field Office, including the Long Island Violent Crime Task Force. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Errol D. Toulon, Jr., and I'm the sheriff of Suffolk County. I would profoundly like to thank the district attorney and the police commissioner for including me not only here today, but for including the Suffolk County Sheriff's Office in recognizing the importance of jail intelligence. It is extremely important when you realize that we created our human trafficking unit in 2018, that there are victims in our community and that intelligence is being shared by many of the men and women who are incarcerated today. And we have seen many disjointed investigations occur, and leading up to the leadership of these two men have really brought everything together. I am proud that today we stand here a little bit closer to bringing closure to the families and extend my deepest condolences to all of you. Because of the nature of this case, and recognizing that human trafficking and corrections intelligence is so important, we realize that there are many other cases that are going on that we will help to solve going forward. So I thank my intelligence staff and team that are here today for their diligence and their work. While we did our part in this investigation, we continue because we have to house this individual. We have already designated or talked about certain locations where we will house him, and in addition, the security measures we will implement in our facility to make sure that this individual is brought to justice the way he should be. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
Good afternoon. I'm Colonel Richard Allen, the field commander with the State Police. And I want to start by expressing my sincere condolences to the family members that are here today. Although losing a loved one, you can never completely get rid of that pain, but hopefully these steps that are taken here today are a step in the right direction for you to start in the healing process or work through the healing process. I want to thank the members of the task force, all the agencies you see behind me. When we were approached in 2022 to be part of this task force, we were fully engaged. Glad to be part of this. We assigned investigators on a full-time basis. You know, what you see being done here today is the end game of agencies working together, as was said before, with no egos, all egos put aside, with the sole mission to find justice for these victims. You know, here in Troop L, Major Stephen Udis oversees the operations down here. He has been intricately involved in this task force since we became partners with it. And I'm going to ask him to come up and say a few words or expand upon this a little bit, our role in the task force. Thank you,
Colonel. Thank you, Colonel. Good afternoon. I'm Major Steve Udis, New York State Police, Troop L, Long Island Troop Commander. I'd like to take this opportunity to start off by acknowledging the DA, Ray Tierney, and Commissioner Rodney Harrison for having the vision to see that forming a task force might breed new light into this investigation. The State Police were asked in early 2022 to join this task force, and once requested, we were more than willing to do so. We were also very pleased that we were able to make some very meaningful contributions in this case to help propel it forward. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of the task force members from the different agencies and congratulate them on a job well done. I think this case represents an example of what we as law enforcement can do when we pool our resources together and we work together. I would also like to mention the State Police member assigned to this task force. You were provided with a mission, and that mission was to participate in this task force, put everything else that you were doing aside, place 100% of your attention on this case, and help push this case forward. You more than accomplished that mission. I congratulate you on a job well done, and I commend you for your outstanding work. To the families, I'd like to say that on behalf of myself and the New York State Police, we offer you our deepest condolences. We recognize that these crimes may have happened years ago, but that pain continues. Our hope is that this development today provides you with some relief and some comfort, knowing that the person responsible for your loved one's death is now being held accountable, and he's no longer a threat to anyone else in society. I want you to know, additionally, that the State Police is not done here. We are remaining committed and will continue to support the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, the Suffolk County Police Department, and this task force as we move into the next phase of this process. That's the prosecution. I would also like to say something to everyone watching this with us today. There's been a lot of discussion here today about charges, about the suspect, about what happened, but I would also like everybody to take the time to join with me and keep the families of the victims and the victims themselves in your thoughts and in your prayers. Each one of these victims was a family member and a loved one, and their void and their loss caused great pain, and they did not deserve this. Nobody is deserving of this. We hope this development today will bring some comfort to them as they move forward. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions?
DA, in court you said that the investigation had to be cut short at one point because of, I think you were carrying the defendant legally, but more importantly, the safety of people in the community. Can you just explain that more here?
You know, sure. Before I do that, I'm standing back there. I realize I didn't thank my own team. I want to thank my chief investigator, Rich Zacharias, who is I am so lucky to have. I want to thank Nick Santamartino, ADA Nick Santamartino, ADA Michelle Haddad, ADA Andrew Lee. I also want to thank my chief assistant, Alan Bodie, and I want to thank all of the incredible analysts that we have working for us at the Suffolk County DA's office. So having said that, I'll now answer your question. I think that there was a tension in the task force, and it was a good tension because, you know, there's a tension between getting the evidence necessary to charge somebody, but also keeping the public safe. And that's the tension that we always deal with. So as we were working forward, we had Suffolk County PD, we had the FBI surveilling the defendant. Obviously, that can't be all the time, but we were reasonably assured with that. But this individual was a person that continued to patronize sex workers at all hours of the night. He continued to use fictitious email addresses, fictitious identities, burner phones. And so as we worked through the case and we got closer and closer, all of a sudden, and we built the evidence, suddenly the balance tips in favor of public safety. So, I think we all wanted as a task force to continue it, but I think collectively we felt that it was time to strike that balance and to take him off the street. So that's what we did.
DA, I see that you have some of the family members gathered here today. Could you introduce some of them if they wanted to say anything about the news?
I don't believe they. Does anybody want to say anything? No, they're here. They're I can tell you they're the Waterman, Bartholomew, and Brainerd Barnes family members, but they're here. They're here first and foremost to support their loved ones, and we're happy and grateful to have them here.
Are you looking at any other people? Do you believe that there are multiple people responsible for the remains for the murders?
This portion had to deal with the deaths of these four young women, and that's what we focused on. That was what the grand jury investigation was focused on. I talked about the commonalities. And the commonalities, all of those commonalities that we talked to were unique to these four separate cases. So that's what we're working on. I think the other members of the task force said, we're going to continue, and continue to work and investigate and try to get a small measure of closure for all the victims' families. But for right now, this defendant, it's this defendant with these four victims.
Do you have the remains? Is there a relationship between the person, the juror, and any other remains other than the four women?
I'm here to talk about what we did with regard to these four victims, and as I open my address by talking about the need to maintain investigative secrecy. So we are going to maintain that investigative secrecy. And when I talk about other individuals and other cases, it will be after they have handcuffs on.
There was a New York State officer made the link with Herman. He looked at data, and that's when Herman came up shortly after the task force.
So, I mean, we talked about some of the evidence that was there. Obviously the cast, that phone evidence, was great evidence, and then there were other commonalities. There were other investigations, but I think one of the good things about having a task force is basically you strip it all down, and you start from scratch, and then you use the DA's office, because the DA's office has to get you the lifeblood of an investigation is information, and the way you get information on a cold case is the district attorney's office issues subpoenas in conjunction with the investigators and executes search warrants again in conjunction with the investigators, and then you mine all that data, and then you let that data take you where you need to go. So that's what we did in this case. And 6 weeks in, the break in the case, a significant break in the case, was the avalanche, and the fact that this guy, he was described by witnesses as an ogre. He matched the description of the ogre and where he lived.
Was the avalanche the link there? Was that jumped out?
Well, I mean, it was a lot of things, right? It was his physical size. It was his where he lived, where he worked. The fact that his family members were out of the country at the time of the commission of the three murders. The fact that he now you start looking into him and then you start getting burner phones. Well, he has we had up to 7 burner phones. He's using these fictitious email addresses. So then you follow him and you get an abandonment sample. Then you go back to some of the old evidence. So it's, you know, there are March 14th, 2022 was a huge day for the task force, but, you know, it's never one piece of evidence. Well, there's what they'll call lawman searches. And basically what it is you run a certain make and model of a car and certain other, you know, where you live or what you do for a living, and then you get data, and then you mine that data for something that would match with your case. And you do that, you don't do that just, you know, you do that 100 times, you know, until it hits, until you get the right data points.
Did the suspect say anything when he was arrested? Was he surprised? Did he admit to the murders?
So we can't talk about ethically in New York, we can't talk about any statements the defendant made, but we're not turning over any statements.
Surprised?
I would say he was, yes.
Did you mention the unique feature that helped you track down the heavy avalanche?
Yeah. So in between the bed and the cab, there's like a little triangular ornament almost, and it's unique. In the way it's configured, it's unique to the avalanche. It was unique to the avalanche at that time. And that was something that was pointed out by witnesses. What? Well, you know, the investigation is continuing, and I would never say never. And we're going to continue to look at, again, now this is a watershed event in this case. And so we've now are going out, and we're executing more search warrants. We'll get more information, more data, and, you know, together we'll look at that and see where it leads.
Can you share what the other victims' families are feeling today?
I'm sorry?
Did you speak to the other victims' families? Did they tell you how they're feeling today?
Which, so this investigation had to do with these four victims, so we've been in touch with the four victims through the grand jury process. With regard to victims in general and other victims, you know, who lost people in the vicinity of that area, you know, we speak to our victims all the time, but those are conversations that we keep between ourselves.
Can you explain why it is one victim that has not been linked to the charges to this suspect?
So, you know, so first off, Maureen Brainerd Barnes, missing in 2009, I believe the others in 2010. She was in 2007, so it was a little bit more remote in time. We are working through evidence. A lot of that evidence has to do with forensic evidence and analyses that are not completed. But once those analyses are completed, we feel good about the case, and we're going to just continue to let that process go. And again, I think the initial plan was to allow the grand jury investigation to go a little further, but at a certain time, again, the task force felt, you know, we need to for reasons having nothing to do with the evidence in the case, we need to take it down.
Can you just sum up this defendant? You've seen a lot. Can you just sum up this defendant?
As a prosecutor and as investigators, you know, he is charged with a crime. There are certain elements in which we need to prove that crime. We are going to prove those elements. We're going to work hard. We're going to convict him, and we're going to hold him responsible for what he did. And whether, you know, what I think of him personally, whether I like him, whether I don't like him, doesn't matter. We are going to hold him responsible for what he did in this case.
The grand jury is
it's a secret. And we're going to keep it secret, but we have an investigation, and it is continuing.
There was a belt that was presented to publicly by the Suffolk County Police Department a few years ago with initials on it. I think one of the initials appeared to be MW, MH or WH or something along those lines. Obviously, this guy's got an H in his name.
Sure does.
Can you talk about that?
I mean, you know, he has an H in his name. He has, so it's, what was it, HM?
Or
WH? Yeah, so he's got an H in his name, and other other relatives in his family have a W in their name. What that means, I don't know.
And can you talk about alleged motive?
I think that when you look at his internet searches, you know, I think that provides a little insight into his state of mind. And again, we don't have to prove motive. We have to prove the elements, and that's what we're going to do.
You said that he was continuing to terrorize sex workers and all these. I mean, how did you guys feel comfortable ensuring that you weren't, you know, putting these women at risk?
Well, you know, you said women. You know, with regard to the sex workers, what we did was we had them under surveillance. We had other means of monitoring him, and again, it's a process, and that process is you have to balance the ability to find enough evidence to charge him and hold him responsible with the balance of keeping the public safe, and it's not easy. And we decided at a certain point in time that that we needed to take him down because we didn't feel comfortable with it, so that's what we did. I don't think it was so much. The searches. I think that the conduct of the defendant was very consistent. I think, but the quality of our evidence was increasing by the day, by the moment, due to the great work of our task force partners. So at a certain point in time, we're like, okay, we can do this.
Was there a murder weapon?
I believe the cause of death is homicidal violence. Obviously, given the length of time and the exposure to a very harsh environment, forensically there was not a lot that could be done with the remains other than come to that conclusion.
He owned 92 guns. There's a set of the arraignment that he had.
He has permits for 92 guns. He has a very large safe in which guns are kept. We are continuing to execute search warrants, so I'm sure we'll have that answer shortly.
There's quite a large gap between when he lost the defendant and his arrest. Is there any concern that he's made any other crimes in that time period before the task force was set up?
I'm sorry?
Is there any concern that obviously when he lost
There's always concerns. I think I got into office in January 22. We worked with our partners. We had our first meeting February 1st, and we worked. And you know, March 14th was really that watershed day. And when I tell you, you know, I'd like to brag and say that my office was really working hard, which we were. But no other agency was working any less hard than we were. Once we realized what we had and we realized the stakes, all of our partners really worked. I think if you look at the folks standing here, I don't think that, you know, in the last 48 hours, any of us have gotten more than 3 hours sleep.
Running Maureen Byrne on Barnes. How much more do you need to actually tie into that?
We are going to continue our investigation, and when we are prepared, when we have concluded that investigation, we will bring that to a conclusion, but we will not do it before.
All right, thank you. You have one more?
Hey, between all the search warrants and the subpoenas, were you ever, think that you were going to lose them? Between all the searching around and stuff?
I don't want to tell you, exact. investigative techniques because they're, you know, again, part of the reasons why they're effective is because people don't necessarily know what that what it is exactly we do. But always a concern, but given the professionalism of our partners, their diligence and their commitment, we felt good about the case or keeping the case going until we didn't, and then we took it down.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
That's the press conference, and that's the latest that we have for you right here. We will continue to follow this for you and bring you breaking updates as they happen. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for joining us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast. This is the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Want more? Start binging on all of our true crime podcasts right now through Apple Podcasts and get an ad-free experience when you sign up to be a True Crime Today Premium Plus member exclusively on Apple Podcasts.
More of the Hidden Killers Podcast, dropping soon.
Press subscribe now.